This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, February 26th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Roby Brock from Talk Business Arkansas speaks with Senator Jane English about the deal she made to switch her vote for the private option. Plus, we have a report on last night's public input forum that was organized by Ozark Regional Transit.
Also, in the latest installment of our monthly Three People series, we have highlights from a panel discussion on civil rights that took place last week on the University of Arkansas campus. Those stories and more, but first, after legislation to refund Arkansas's private option failed to pass in the State House of Representatives on four different occasions last week, legislative leaders are acknowledging that little progress is being made to keep the program alive. In the House yesterday, the bill to refund the health care program, which provides private insurance to low-income people using federal Medicaid dollars, did not come up for a vote. House Speaker Davy Carter says his chamber is still two votes shy of getting the needed 3-4 supermajority.
The reality of the situation is this, that either A, there have to be a couple of people that that support the measure as is, or B, there has to be somebody has to produce something that goes through budget and unwinds the Senate and gets 3-4 support in this chamber.
Republican State Representative Nate Bell introduced amendments that limit outreach for the private option as a way of garnering support for its funding bill among opponents. But Bell says he's still trying to find new ways to pass the program in this fiscal session.
Negotiations are ongoing with anybody who's willing to talk. But, you know, I think every reasonable person in the state of Arkansas understands that a complete wind down, a complete defund, or an early defund are simply not on the table. I understood that many months ago, and that's why I've taken the route to try to find a reasonable path forward. And unfortunately, several members don't see it that way.
Bell, an opponent of the private option, says he is trying to find a way to pass the program this session because there is not enough support in the legislature to defund the program.
Judge James Moody has been successfully confirmed to serve as U.S. District Court Judge for the Eastern District of Arkansas. According to Talk Business Arkansas, yesterday Moody was confirmed by a 95-4 vote in the U.S. Senate. President Obama originally nominated Moody for the federal judgeship in July. For the past decade, he has served as circuit judge for the 3rd Division of the 6th Judicial District of Arkansas, and he previously served as a partner at Wright, Lindsay, and Jennings in Little Rock. Both Senators John Bozeman and Mark Pryor voted in favor of Moody's appointment to the federal bench.
Some employees of the city of Fayetteville could soon see a bump in pay. Yesterday, the city council discussed raises during its agenda session. Those pay raises would entail a 3.8% pay increase on average for police and fire personnel, a similar merit for other employees, and a one-time service award for employees currently at the top end of their respective pay scales. If approved by the City Council, the raises would go into effect in April.
The Cherokee Nation in Stillwell, Oklahoma, will break ground later this week on an expansion that will add 28,000 square feet to the existing Wilma P. Mankiller Health Center in Stillwell. According to Cherokee Nation officials, the project is the 4th of 5 healthcare infrastructure projects in which $100 million of casino profits would be invested.
Gas prices are on the rise in Arkansas. Yesterday, regular unleaded gasoline reached a state average of $3.23 per gallon, up 6 cents since last week. Mike Wright of AAA Auto Club says at this time of year, a price rise is not uncommon.
We've seen crude oil prices ratchet up in recent days, and that's driven up wholesale gasoline prices, and it's not unusual to see prices rise this time of year. In fact, last year at this time, we were paying $3.64 a gallon.
Wright also says that, overall, gas prices are expected to be cheaper this year than in 2013. Prices in Arkansas are still below the national rate of $3.43 per gallon.
The University of Arkansas in Fayetteville has created a new vice provost position designed to provide better support for the campus's faculty. According to the university, Ro DeBrezzo, the vice provost for academic affairs, has been named to fill the new post of vice provost for faculty development and enhancement. The new position will oversee the Teaching and Faculty Support Center, the Teaching Academy, and the Associate Professor Mentorship Program.
Much of rockabilly music got its start in Arkansas, and there is an increasing interest in how this state played a part in popularizing the genre. Arkansas State University's Museum will present the second Rockabilly Boogie Fest Saturday at the ASU Military Services Building in downtown Jonesboro. Dr. Marty Allen, director of the ASU Museum, says Northeast Arkansas was a catalyst for the unique genre of music.
There is a widespread regional movement, I guess you could say, now to restore rockabilly in our in the music mainstream, or at least the music consciousness of our region, because it's been missing for quite a while, even though it's been playing all the time. Many people in this region don't realize how important this is to the roots music heritage of our region and, of course, to the world, because rockabilly didn't just grow up here and stay here and die here. It moved on to Europe and it has been continually a rage in Europe since the early 1970s.
Proceeds from the event will benefit a rockabilly exhibit at the museum. Performers include the Stunning Cunning Band, Charlie Rich, Junior, and Sonny Burgess and the Legendary Pacers.
Clear tonight with lows from 16 in northwest Arkansas to 21 in the Arkansas River Valley. Expect sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 42 and a wind chill as low as 8 in northwest Arkansas and a high near 51 in the Arkansas River Valley. Mostly clear tomorrow night with a low around 26 in northwest Arkansas and a 20% chance of showers and a low around 29 in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas House is still debating the passage of the private option. The Arkansas Senate, on the other hand, passed the bill last week. That outcome was affected by a swing vote that hinged on the concept of overhauling the state's workforce training efforts. Recently, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas spoke with State Senator Jane English of North Little Rock and Shane Broadway, director of the Arkansas Department of Higher Education, about what changes could be made to workforce training in the future. During their conversation, Roby asked Senator English at what point she realized she might have the leverage she had been looking for 30 years in terms of making something transformational change in workforce development.
I actually probably didn't even realize it until about last Thursday, and had a meeting with the governor and the cabinet staff, Shane, and Department of Economic Development and Workforce Services, and everybody was very positive and excited about the possibility of turning the system upside down.
Shane, tell me how that conversation went. How did it start? How did it go?
Well, we were all summoned to a meeting. It was interesting. We were summoned to a meeting at the governor's office, but nobody knew exactly who was coming and why we were there. And so we all get up to the top of the staircase looking at one another saying, are you supposed to be in this meeting? So, but the conversation began with that Senator English had an interest in looking at changing and really doing a thorough look at what we're doing in terms of workforce training. So from those of us on the workforce cabinet side, Grant Tenniel at Economic Development, R.T. Williams, we've been talking about this for the last year in terms of looking towards January in the next session. And so what Senator English essentially did, we were almost kicking each other on the table saying, this is what we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And essentially, and that's the term we're using for it, is fast track. Her advocacy for doing the things that we know we need to do in terms of putting people in jobs, what we were looking at doing has now been fast-tracked, and we're very excited about it.
So, Senator English, you talk about turning the thing upside down, turning workforce training, workforce programs upside down. What does that mean? What do you want to see done that's completely different than what we're seeing presently?
I'd like us to begin to look at, we talk at the federal level, there's 47 different training programs, and they're all in a silo. Well, what we have probably in some instances, some of the same thing here. We've got programs throughout state government, not just higher ed and two-year colleges, but we've got lots of programs. And we need to identify all those programs, where those funds are. And those things that are working well, then we need to make sure we continue doing those. Those things that aren't working well and aren't performing and don't have any results need to be going by the wayside so we can do something else. Another thing that I'm very interested in is I think we have so many kids who are in the 8th grade, 9th grade, and if they don't drop out mentally, physically, they drop out mentally. Mm-hmm. And we have a box for kids. And if you don't fit in that box, and we've always had that box, if you don't fit in that box, then you kind of drop out, and then those people become unsuccessful. And we've got to find a way to have an alternate path so that kids can go and get a high school diploma and also get some skills training. Algebra can be taught in a number of different ways. It doesn't have to just be in a classroom. So I think there are, and the business community has to be very involved in this. We keep hearing them say they have 38,000 jobs out there that they can't fill because they don't have people to fill those jobs and with the skills. So I think this is all a mechanism to figure out exactly what is the end product we want to have and how are we going to move the resources in that direction.
And by moving the resources, Shane, I'll come to you with this question. You're talking about maybe there's a two-year school in Northeast Arkansas that has the ability to produce X number of mold injection factory workers, but the jobs aren't there in Northeast Arkansas. Maybe they're in Southwest Arkansas or Western Arkansas. And so you're talking about moving some of those resources from one school to another. What are we talking about conceptually?
It will depend on the particular situation. The first thing we're going to do is assess these jobs. Right. If they're 38,000, 45, however many they are, what types of jobs are they and where are they? And that will be done with the Economic Development, Department of Workforce Services, the State Chamber, business community. They will do that assessment. What then we will do with higher ed and the two-year college is assess what programs we have statewide and where they are to match those jobs. And if we do have a need in some place where it's not, the pot that we're assembling together through AADC can be utilized to put if we need a welding course or more welders. So you're able to produce 50 welders, but industry says they need 100. So you need another welding machine. So the pot that we're collecting and combining the resources together can be utilized to put that other welding machine there. Or if somebody has a piece of equipment that's not being utilized because there's not industry there, then work out arrangements to move that equipment from one corner of the state to the other.
What's the time frame for the assessment portion of this? Is this something that we're talking about is going to be done in six months' time?
We're already moving in that direction.
Yeah, we're already starting.
Will there be a report issued on this, or how will we?
I think there will be. I think what we have to do is look at what all is it that we're talking about and figure out what our game plan really is. And one of the things that Shane talked about is, you know, for so many years we've had money going to two-year colleges, and it's been by a formula, and in many cases there isn't enough money for them to do anything. They don't have the resources to be able to hire a certified whatever, and they don't have the money to buy the equipment, and equipment is so expensive. Mm-hmm. So in order to be able to buy some and to have the appropriate things, we need to make sure that the resources are there, and that includes the private sector, and hopefully they will come to the table as well.
Is there going to be any backlash from two-year schools that might be losing money, losing programs, or are there some that might want to shut down some legacy programs?
We'll look at all that.
We met with the two-year colleges by conference call Monday. Senator English talked with you on Monday and others on Monday and walked them through. I mean, the prospects, if you look at it, if private option doesn't pass, certainly higher education normally takes the brunt of a budget cut. Mm-hmm. There were other ideas on the table initially that could have been more detrimental to the two-year colleges. By the time we worked through all the process and got to Monday and were able to put everything together, their base is secure. Their base is not going to change. There's money going forward that they might have received that they're not going to receive. But now, for the first time ever, they have a pool of money, because there's so many times they come to us and say, we really need to put in this program, but we don't have the money for the equipment or the money to get it started up. So now, really, for the first time, we're going to have a pool that they'll be able to come in and access to be able to start the program based on the need of industry and especially based on a partner in industry. So I think as it becomes and evolves, I think you'll have everybody on board, because everybody sees the need that we have out there. We have so many Arkansans that have either a high school diploma or less, or some college but no degree. who, with a little bit of training, can access some very high-paying jobs mm-hmm. out there that are going to help also.
You're talking 70,000, 80,000, even higher, 120,000 in some management positions.
And to Senator English's point that she said a lot this week, the goal here is to upwardly move these people so that they're not dependent upon government assistance. And we have programs like that now with our Career Pathways program that takes people who are eligible or who are on government assistance and gets them into college and gets them out into the workplace where they're not dependent upon that. And that's really the goal.
All right, I got time for one last question. Senator English, you changed your vote on the private option, controversial move to do that. What's been the response since you've cast that vote in favor of the private option from both sides of the aisle in terms of the support of the
option? There are an awful lot of people that are pleased that we're doing something. I've heard from an awful lot of business folks who are very pleased that we're looking at doing something that would help them. You know, we forget these are residents and citizens of the state of Arkansas. Everybody we're talking about is a resident, and there are lots of good job possibilities, but even below industry training type things, when you're talking about high school diplomas and GEDs and folks who may have not made the best decision when they were in high school, dropped out, but they're 25.
But are you getting love mail or hate mail is what I'm asking.
A little bit of both.
A little bit of both. Nothing you can't handle?
No.
All right.
That was Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas speaking to State Senator Jane English of North Little Rock and Shane Broadway, Director of the Arkansas Department of Higher Education. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, encouraging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
The Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity: coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. Their mission is to promote a pro-business free enterprise agenda and prevent anti-business legislation, regulation, and rules. Learn more at ArkansasStateChamber.com.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blue Show, which airs every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Join me this Friday, and I've got a 1978 recording, Levon Helm, recording with what would be later the Blues Brothers Band, with Ernie and Earl Cade on background vocals. Also, Marsha Ball, Tedeschi Trucks Band, and blues guitarist and vocalist Carolyn Wonderland, who will make several appearances in Arkansas in the next few months. That's the Generic Blue Show, every Friday night at 9 o'clock. We'll see you then.
Coming up in about 10 minutes on Ozarks, we take a hike with a cartographer who's mapping the Ozark Highlands Trail.
We're at the start of it here at Lake Fort Smith State Park, and the trail does stretch almost all the way to the Missouri borderline, where it'll meet up with the Ozark Trail in Missouri and hopefully stretch all the way to St. Louis. So it'll be a trans-Ozark Trail from Lake Fort Smith State Park to St. Louis, Missouri.
That story's just ahead on Ozarks at Large.
Ozark Regional Transit is in the middle of a six-month process of tweaking its transit routes in Benton and Washington counties. That process includes public input sessions, one of which was held in Fayetteville last night. As Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis reports, the route changes are a move by the Transit Authority to better serve the public.
The population of Northwest Arkansas is growing by about 23 people a day. Joel Gardner, the executive director of Ozark Regional Transit, says that he's not sure if the Transit Authority can keep up with that rapid pace of growth, but he feels that ORT can make an impact on commuting in the area.
Once we establish routes that are where people want to go, timely, safe, and the community understands it, we can help alleviate some of the congestion on the road by getting people where they need to go if they choose to use public transit. We want to have people that are choosing to use public transit.
But establishing routes where all of the area's transit-riding residents want to go isn't as simple as just adding more buses. Jeff Hatley is the public information officer for Ozark Regional Transit.
Because there's a whole infrastructure that has to go in, believe it or not. We're at our growth point, I would think, with the amount of buses that we have. We can fulfill these needs. If we grow very much more, we're going to have to buy more buses, which means more bus drivers, which means more dispatchers. It's obviously more administrative. There's more fuel, the whole thing. So it really is a lot about money. It's not all about money, but it's a lot about money.
And ORT does have more money to work with this year. The city of Fayetteville increased its commitment to $300,000 for the Transit Authority, and Washington County also upped its contribution by about $100,000 to nearly $123,000. Those additional dollars are why Ozark Regional Transit is able to make several changes to its routes in Springdale, Fayetteville, Rogers, and Bentonville. Specifically, Washington County's increased subsidy allows for the creation of Route 620. Kendall Llewellyn is a senior analyst at ORT.
It's going to be a more of a rural route coming from the Lincoln, Prairie Grove, and Farmington area into the Lot 56 area, and also servicing down to Greenland and West Fork. Be doing that throughout the day.
He says that there was previously a similar rural route, but it was discontinued a few years ago.
There was some little ridership on it, but it just wasn't marketed correctly. We just didn't do it right at that time. But we're feel confident that this route, we're getting out there, we're meeting with these communities. We've got somebody that's going to be out there meeting with different organizations and telling them about it. And so I'm really confident this is going to be a good route for people coming into town and then can connect with the rest of our system or Razorback Transit and get to where they need to go.
That new rural route is still in the design phase, and it won't be implemented until June. But other changes will be coming to the transit system's routes in Fayetteville sooner than that. For instance, starting next month, Route 40, which runs between Hillcrest Towers in Fayetteville and Ozark Guidance in Springdale, will be split in two at Northwest Arkansas Mall. Another route getting split is Route 41, which currently runs from the Walmart Supercenter on Martin Luther King Boulevard over to Beard's Funeral Chapel on Huntsville Road. Llewellyn says that the route will be split into an east and a west route, and that the west route will add some previously unserved areas.
On the west side, it will still head out towards Martin Luther King Boulevard, the Walmart, service Walmart, but it's also going to go south and service some areas on Cato Springs Road, like the Crown Ridge Apartments, and then all the way down to the Clydesdale and service the Washington County Operations Center down there. And then that'll be mainly the west side. It's still service Lot 56 for connections at Lot 56 to our Route 54, which is our commuter express that heads up to Bentonville Rogers. A lot of NWAC students ride that.
And new service areas will be added to the eastern half of Route 41 as well.
We're going to try and get out to service the Cliffs Apartments that's on Crossover. We've not been in that area, so that's a new service area for us. Also, we're going to hit the Industrial Park area. It's also going to come back up, still service Nantucket Apartments, and the Fable Senior Center and places like that.
Llewellyn says that the main reason for splitting routes in half, like is being done to Route 41, is to increase the frequency by which buses get to scheduled stops.
It's frustrating to get on a bus and you have to wait an hour to get all the way back around. More frequent bus is what we're looking at. And yes, service in more service areas. We've never been more toward the east side of town. Now we're getting up close to the Cliffs Apartments. We haven't had the time to get down to the industrial park where transportation is sorely needed down there. Now we're going to be able to service that with more frequent service.
But splitting routes is only one type of change Ozark Regional Transit is making. Route 47, which serves the north side of Fayetteville, will be tweaked for timing and to also go into Johnson via Wilkerson Street. Joel Gardner, the ORT executive director, says that pushing that route into Johnson is part of a two-pronged approach into the town.
One of the big things with Johnson is we're going to be able to address Johnson from both Fayetteville and from Springdale. So we're going to have a portion of the Route 47 right here going up into Johnson. And then a portion of the Route 43 from Springdale is going to also come down into Johnson. So we will be able to take people from Johnson into a Fayetteville connector or from Johnson up into a Springdale connector. That's probably one of the biggest steps in really making it all one large transportation community from Bentonville Rogers all the way down to West Fork.
And as the region continues to grow, Gardner says that public transit can help alleviate growing traffic problems as well.
If you look at how many seats One of our average size buses will hold, it's 28 seats. That's just sitting people. That doesn't include the standing people. 28 individual drivers at an average car length of, 17 and a half feet for an average car length. That's a significant chunk of 540 or 71 business that we are taking off the road. And less wear and tear on the road itself, less congestion.
But as all the ORT officials at the public input session reiterated, further growth to the system, like extending routes into more rural areas and adding more buses to routes for better frequency, is dependent on how much money the Transit Authority receives and on people actually using the service. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
It is Wednesday, February 26th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And joining us now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Isn't it time where we say, what happened to February?
It's about
yes,
that time.
Yes, definitely.
I don't get it. I don't get it. Oh,
I give February a pass just because it's a shorter month anyway.
Yeah.
So I blame it on that to make myself feel better.
I'm trying to decide if this is the month I was supposed to get my car tag.
Ooh, I
might want to scurry on out of here. We better both scurry on out of here.
Well, tell us some things first.
Okay. If you're going on the road mm-hmm. and you have a current car tag.
I do.
You can go to Tulsa for some music.
I love going to Tulsa for music. I really do.
On March 15th, Third Day and Skillet at the BOK Center.
Mm-hmm.
On March 28th, Lady Antebellum, mm-hmm. also at the BOK Center. And on March 29th, finally, a musician whose name I recognize, Cher, at the BOK Center.
That's right. And if you miss her there, I know she's coming to Little Rock, I think a little, probably after that, sometime mm-hmm. in March.
Mm-hmm. Actually, the Little Rock date is March 28th.
Thank you.
So the day before.
The day before. All right. Thank you.
Also in Tulsa, Kings of Leon on April 8th, same location. George Strait on April 19th. Mm-hmm. The Dave Matthews Band on May 21st, and Bruno Mars on June 4th.
I recognize several.
Yeah, you're much more in tune with that than I am. No pun intended. If you're going to Dallas, I know this name too. March 13th, Elton John at the American Airlines Center. And in Little Rock, again, Cher on March 28th, and Bruno Mars on June 10th. So join Antoinette and hit the road for every concert you can think of.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is folk singer Michael Jonathan inviting you to stay tuned for the 700th broadcast of Wood Songs. We're celebrating with Big Bad Voodoo Daddy.
Zulu man, feeling blue. Hear his heartbeat, little tattoo. Singing digga digga doo, digga doo doo.
It's the next broadcast of the Wood Songs. Old time radio hour.
Listen Saturday at 2 p.m. to KUAF 3.
It's been a long and frigid winter, but soon things will warm and avid hikers will hit the Ozarks trails. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us on the Ozark Highlands Trail to meet a cartographer who's mapping it.
I'm Christian Underwood, owner of Underwood Geographics.
Christian Underwood moved to the Ozarks 10 years ago with his spouse, Elizabeth, to pursue a master's in geography at the University of Arkansas, which completed in 2009. The couple loved it so much, they stayed, purchasing a small parcel in Winslow. That's where, in 2011, Christian opened his firm, and he's undertaken a most ambitious project, mapping the Ozark Highlands Trail.
We're at the start of it here at Lake Fort Smith State Park, and the trail does stretch almost all the way to the Missouri borderline, where it'll meet up with the Ozark Trail in Missouri and hopefully stretch all the way to St. Louis. So it'll be a trans-Ozark Trail from Lake Fort Smith State Park to St. Louis, Missouri.
The Ozark Highlands Trail's worn and well-blazed, he said, but it penetrates some of the most wild and rugged territory in the state.
There's a series of Forest Service maps that have been out since the 1990s, and they have not been updated since the 1990s. And unfortunately, due to budget cuts, the Forest Service doesn't have the revenue to update their maps.
Noted Ozarks wilderness photographer Tim Ernst published a guidebook on the Ozark Highlands Trail, which notes many features, but Christian's maps will be based on state-of-the-art GPS coordinates.
Well, the equipment that I use is a Trimble GPS or a differential GPS unit, so it's a highly accurate piece of equipment. It's kind of a field computer, and it gets great reception down in the hollows.
Using the handheld devices, he's able to take constant readings and note features along the way, working in 7 to 10-mile increments.
And then if I come across something interesting, I'll take a waypoint, a specific location. And this unit allows me to make notes as I'm collecting this waypoint. So I can say, oh, this is a waterfall, or this is a beautiful cave, or this is an old homestead.
Mapping human traces is Christian's undergraduate degree in anthropology.
As an archaeologist. And when you're doing archaeology, you're digging and you're also mapping about every 10 centimeters. You have to make a map because once you dig up a feature, it's no longer there. So you have to continuously document it with photographs and maps. And I really enjoyed making the maps. It was fun. And it eventually landed me a job mapping and surveying all the caves on a Fort Leonard Wood military installation.
Which introduced him to the karsty Ozarks and got him hooked on cartography mapmaking. His first job was in North Carolina, where his wife was taking her master's.
To map the Bartram Trail in western North Carolina. It stretches from the Chattooga River in South Carolina, Georgia, all the way up to the Appalachian Trail. The section in North Carolina where I mapped is about 84 miles long.
Christian had been hiking the Ozark Highlands National Recreation Trail for some time on his own and had been mapping certain features. That's when he decided to pitch the concept of a map to the Trail Association, which is responsible for constructing and maintaining it.
And they loved the idea. I mean, they wanted a map of it as well. So we're just in the process of raising funds. I mean, it's more them in the process of soliciting funds from, it might be cities or private businesses, wherever it may be, but get the to raise the funds to pay for the cartographic work and the printing. The printing is not an inexpensive process. It does cost money to get those large maps printed and folded on waterproof, tear-proof paper.
Christian's collected data on 150 of 218 constructed miles of trail so far. The total length is 256 miles with the northern route crossing the White River at Norfolk Lake into Missouri. John Pennington serves as vice president of the Ozark Highlands Trail Association.
So we are very excited to be working with Underwood Geographics to have a series of new maps created for the Highlands Trail that can aid in a hiker's enjoyment of the trail, increase tourism to the cities and counties that the trail is located near, and then also to help us maintain the trail as we go through time.
Christian Underwood's mapped turf is expanding. He's mapped the Shawnee National Forest Trail in southern Illinois, as well as other trails in western North Carolina. And his work has other applications.
Yes, so I do make maps and graphics for authors of books, for professors. So I've worked a lot with University of Arkansas professors in Oaxaca, Mexico, and the Nez Perce battles in Idaho and Montana. Surprisingly enough, we do a lot of mapping of statistical data, visualizing statistical data, so you're not looking at numbers or columns and rows of numbers. You can get something and synthesize the data and understand what the data are saying in a matter of seconds rather than trying to crunch numbers.
Infographics. Think weather maps. Underwood, who is 37, tall and skinny, spends his free time hiking with his wife Elizabeth, who is Executive Director of Governmental and Community Affairs at UA Fort Smith. So far, they've tackled several dozen states. But he spends springs on whitewater. Last year, he combined both passions, mapping while paddling the Mulberry River. He's remapping the whitewater section for local outfitter Brad Wimberly, who operates Turner Bend. The USGS has stream maps, he says, but the river course has changed due to recent massive flooding.
It's a wild and scenic river. It depends if you look at the Little Mulberry or the Mulberry. It starts in either Fallsville or Red Star, Arkansas, and it makes its way, it more or less travels due west and makes its way all the way to the Arkansas River, just south of the town of Mulberry, Arkansas.
Using his GPS equipment, Christian's mapped 64 miles of the river.
It took me about 2 months to collect the data, and it's not every day that I was out there, but over the course of 2 months, I was able to collect all the data. So running a 5-mile section one day, and maybe next weekend I'd run another 5-mile section, or maybe a 10-mile section, just depending on the length of day. We had a nice wet fall, which is kind of abnormal for Arkansas, and that afforded me the opportunity to get out more frequently, and the days were longer, so I could stay out longer.
Maps being printed by Vision Graphics, based in Colorado, which prints all of National Geographic's maps, by the way.
The final product is going to be a typical topographic map that hikers use, kind of similar to the one of the Buffalo National River, the ones that Trails Illustrated has put out. So it's going to be a folded map. It's going to be on waterproof, tearproof paper. But it's really interesting right there, so you do get to see some neat faults. And it's interesting how on the north side of the river you have the Ozark Plateau, and on the south you're really getting into that Arkoma Basin.
The Mulberry River map should be available mid-March, just in time for spring floating. And the Ozark Highlands Trail map, it will be a folio of three maps, the first section scheduled for completion this fall. And recreational cartographer Christian Underwood has already set his sights on his next project, mapping the Ouachita Trail. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To learn more, visit ugeographics.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. There are a couple of noteworthy events coming up at Northwest Arkansas Community College. Saturday evening from 6 to 9:30, NWAC is hosting a jam night at Gusano's in Bentonville as part of the college's Spring Arts Festival. The house band includes singer O.C. Fisher, drummer Richard Goodrum, NWAC instructor Mark Turner on bass, and NWAC student Matthew Mazzoni on guitar. Those interested in performing with the house band, bringing their own band, or performing a solo, may contact Mark Turner by emailing mturner1@nwacc.edu or by calling 619-4126.
NWAC will host a concealed carry forum from 3 to 4 p.m. March 5th, that's a week from today, in White Auditorium. The forum will be an opportunity for individuals to provide feedback on Arkansas Act 226 of 2013, which pertains to the concealed carry of handguns on campus by permit holders who are full-time college faculty and staff members. In May of 2013, the Board of Trustees adopted a policy disallowing the carrying of a concealed handgun by full-time faculty and staff members in buildings and grounds owned or controlled by the college. As required within the Act, the Board of Trustees policy expires 1 year after adoption and must be readopted each year by the Board of Trustees to remain in effect.
On March 10th, NWAC's Drama Department will hold auditions for its upcoming production of The Giver. Performances are scheduled for April 25th through the 27th and May 1st through the 3rd. The Giver describes a utopian society in which everyone is the same. There is no choice and no freedom to be an individual. But sameness comes at a price. Auditions will be at 6 p.m. March 10th in White Auditorium. Both children and adults are needed. Children's roles are available for girls 6 to 8 years old, and for both girls and boys 11 to 13 years old. No experience is necessary. Rehearsals will be every Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday from 6 to 9 p.m. beginning March 11th. Those interested in working on scenery, lighting, video production, sound, and costumes should also attend auditions on March 10th. For information, contact Mary Moore at mmoore@nwacc.edu or by calling 479-619-4228.
Friday evening, Fayetteville Underground will host a closing reception for Robert Ross's exhibition, The Muse in the Woodwork at the Water's Edge and Watercolor Studies of Watery Places. There is also a documentary being shot about Ross, and guests will be able to ask questions to those creating this film. Food and drinks will be provided, and the local trio Outside the Lines will also be having an informal rehearsal during the reception. The event is scheduled for 6 to 8 p.m. and is free and open to the public. For more, you can visit FayettevilleUnderground.com.
Fayetteville artist Linda Sheets, independent publisher of two books with her scratchboard drawings of rescued dogs and cats, has launched another book project on the crowdsourcing site Kickstarter. Linda has until March 6 to raise $9,500 that she needs for her project. Chicken Scratchin' will be a collection of Linda's scratchboard drawings of backyard and urban chickens from around the world, including short stories provided by the owners about the birds. Local poet Miller Williams assisted in the editing of the first two books. For more information, visit Kickstarter.com and search for Linda Sheets.
This is Ozarks at Large. Last week, the University of Arkansas Library's Special Collections Department hosted a forum dedicated to the life of Daisy Bates, African-American-owned newspapers, and civil rights in Arkansas. Janice Kearney, author of the book Daisy, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, talked about Bates and her newspaper, Arkansas State Press. Later, she was joined by two journalists, Gerald Jordan and Roy Reed, to discuss coverage of civil rights. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums attended the forum and has this report.
Janice Kearney calls Daisy Gadsden Bates a mentor and a role model. Janice Kearney received her journalism degree from the University of Arkansas and eventually would become the managing editor for the paper launched by Daisy Bates and her husband, L.C. Bates. Daisy first became known to a national audience during the events leading up to the integration of Little Rock Central High School in the mid to late 1950s. Last week at the forum at the University of Arkansas's library, Janice Kearney told the audience Daisy Bates was also the only woman to speak at the March on Washington in August 1963.
Yet her role on that hot August day to acknowledge the women and the struggle was a last-minute thought. This woman, who had been recognized as a great addition to the NAACP board for her tireless efforts to lead the Arkansas Civil Rights March for Equality, had been selected Woman of the Year in 1957, had received, along with the Little Rock Nine, the incomparable Spingarn Award in 1959 for hers and the Little Rock Nine's valor in the face of unheard-of challenges. Daisy Lee Gadsden Bates, a woman of many words, was relegated to speaking only 142 words that day. But those words would bring the audience to their feet as she spoke to the work and the struggle of women and children throughout the country. No better choice could have been made to speak those words. 1957 in Arkansas had been a year of hardships, of struggle for Daisy Gadsden Bates. It had tested her commitment, her courage, her resilience, but it had also prepared her for that sweltering hot day in 1963. Daisy, who had stood up to the harsh challengers of the Brown decision and the hate-filled threats she and her husband had endured day in and day out, the crosses burned in their yards, the continued defacing of their home, the ultimate loss of their beloved and prominent Arkansas State Press newspaper. She would stand up also to those blacks who told her that she was maybe asking for too much, that it would be okay to wait for integration. Most valiantly and with a strong voice, she would stand up to Governor Orville Faubus.
Following Janice Kearney's talk about Daisy Bates, she was joined by Gerald Jordan and Roy Reed to talk about civil rights and civil rights coverage by the press. Both men are journalists with deep Arkansas connections. Jordan, a professor in the University of Arkansas's journalism department, is teaching a class about the history of the black press.
So much material got lost because of how
little or lowly regarded African-American newspapers were from their founding, Freedom's Journal in 1827, through the Civil War era, through the Reconstruction era. So much of that is just plain lost. And I believe Dr. Robinson will bear me out on this, that some of it is being found in attics and in garages and storerooms, and people are finding these marvelous troves of material that so many scholars thought were lost forever. So we are getting smarter about collecting that material, and as scholars get into it and publish research on that, we find so many repeat cycles in the politics of the United States. Laws that were passed to repeal, in effect, the good things that were done in Reconstruction. You think, well, that was so retro, it was such a failed policy, there's no way that people would try that again. Well, guess what? There are people who think we can still make another run at repealing people's voting rights, and let's see how far we get this time. So I think our students are learning vital lessons from a course like History of the Black Press.
Roy Reed saw many of the civil rights developments of the 1950s and 60s firsthand. After 9 years as a reporter for the Arkansas Gazette, he was hired by the New York Times in 1965 to cover civil rights. Later, he would write the definitive biography of Orville Faubus, a major figure in the battle over the integration of Central High. During last week's forum on the University of Arkansas campus, Roy Reed spoke about the relationship between the Bates and Governor Faubus.
They were the public enemies, and everybody knew it. They were the two faces of the integration crisis. Little known to anybody except a handful of people in state government, L.C. Bates was a quiet political advisor to Governor Faubus. I'm not sure who made the first move. I suspect it was the governor reaching out to L.C. Bates and saying, please recommend some black people who would be good for this or that position in state government. And by the time it was over, and I think this covered a period of 4 or 5 years that lasted until 1969 when Faubus left office, the relationship, this almost invisible relationship between these two men, resulted in about 100 positions opened up to black people in state government that probably would not have been opened up to if it hadn't been for this quiet, I won't call it friendship. Now, Orville, in his sly way, when I interviewed him about this in the late 80s or early 90s, he said something like, L.C. and I had always been friends. And he said it with such a grin, he wanted me to know that I knew and he knew that this was a lie. They weren't friends. At best, they were joined in a practical matter of politics. You scratch my back and I'll scratch yours.
Janice Kearney says she titled her biography, Daisy, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, because Daisy Bates felt immense pressure from various sides during Arkansas's high-profile struggle with civil rights in the 1950s.
Not only during the 1957 era, from both blacks and whites, mm-hmm. from women who didn't feel like she should be out there, but she had it from childhood. Her life seemed to have always pitted her, you know, right in the middle of things, and she had to fight her way. Life was a challenge for her. So I think it is kind of a celebration that she was able to do as well as she did and become the leader that she became in spite of the things that pulled against her throughout her whole history. So that's kind of what I was thinking of when I came up with Between a Rock and a Hard Place. Does that answer? Okay.
And one of the things that we're learning in History of the Black Press is there's never been a monolithic black view. that there's always been differences, that even the two founders of Freedom's Journal split on the question of the American Colonization Society, the Back to Africa movement. Mm-hmm. That one said, no, we were born in America. I am not leaving here. This is my country. And of course, later in the Reconstruction era, mm-hmm. there were some publishers, editors who said, you know, y'all are pushing stuff too fast. You're making it hard on us. So there's always been that split. Now, of course, I was aware through your book and others that Mrs. Bates caught plenty of flack.
She did.
Plenty of flack.
Could you talk a little bit about the Southern Mediator Journal in Little Rock, the rival paper to the state press? Because that was a good example of this division we're talking about.
Yeah, and I don't know much about the Southern Mediator. That was before I got there. It was no longer in operation when I got to Little Rock and started working for Daisy Bates.
Sure.
But I do understand that there was a challenge. It was a challenge to have two black newspapers, for one thing. And the Southern Mediator, I understand, was not as progressive, not as
it was a church paper.
Yeah. They didn't challenge the status quo to the extent that Arkansas State Press did. So there was a little, you know, struggle between those two. And Daisy and Elsie really, they grew the Arkansas State Press way beyond anything that the Southern Mediator could ever.
Well, but at one point, Mr. Jones, I think his name was, who owned the Mediator, he began to collect advertising from white business owners that had gone to the Bates in their newspaper before, and that led to the financial difficulties that they had with the state press.
Mm-hmm.
And he was getting, I don't remember how his paper ended. I am aware that by the time you came along, it was gone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there were threats by advertisers, too, that...
It was what?
Threats against advertisers for the state press. That you keep on advertising that paper,
that's
I'm taking
exactly.
all my business away from you.
Yeah, that was a big reason that advertisements pull out of state press.
We heard excerpts from a forum about Daisy Bates and civil rights in Arkansas that was held last week on the University of Arkansas campus and hosted by the U of A's libraries and the library's Special Collections Department. The panel included Janice Kearney, the author of the book Daisy, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, Gerald Jordan, a professor of journalism at the University of Arkansas, and Roy Reed, author of several books, including Phobos, The Life and Times of an American Prodigal. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
We'll have just a bit more from that forum Sunday morning on Weekend Ozarks at Large. Gerald Jordan and Janice Kearney, both graduates of the University of Arkansas, we'll discuss their experiences in the late 1960s and early 1970s as African-American undergraduate students at the predominantly white U of A. That's on Weekend Ozarks at Large, Sunday morning at 9 here on KUAF.
John Brown University welcomes world-renowned baritone Jubilant Sykes to the Barry Performing Arts Center in Siloam Springs this Friday night at 7:30 p.m. Jubilant Sykes has performed at the Metropolitan Opera, Carnegie Hall, the Kennedy Center, and many other premier venues around the world. Seating is limited. Tickets are available at 524-7382 or jbu.edu/tickets.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Jasper.
And before we go, we have some winners to announce. Yesterday, we had a trivia contest for two pairs of tickets to the Sowita Gospel Choir, who's coming to the Walnut Center, part of the 10x10 art series. That'll be March 6th, though, next Thursday. The question we asked was, what is the largest country in Africa in terms of population? The answer is Nigeria. And we're giving away two pairs of two tickets. So our two winners, Christina, are?
They are Bo Smith and Nathaniel Franks. So each one of you wins one pair of tickets to that show.
Mm-hmm.
We will email you and let you know that you can pick your tickets up at Will Call.
So thanks to everybody who participated. And I know we're going to be giving away some more tickets tomorrow. So tune in tomorrow for that.
That's right.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Have a great Wednesday.